May you come to order? So we have two bills today, both of them dealing with manufactured homes. And I just wanted to remind people as well that we do have a committee meeting Thursday, tomorrow at 4:30 in the committee here. And we're having extra meetings because we're having more long discussions, and that's fine. It just means we have to make up time at other parts of the week. So we have a lot of bills before that come into our committee as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
In that 4 o'clock hearing tomorrow, if we do get the 98 inches of snow that they're talking about, is that going to create a problem for members of this committee and or people that testify? That's a very good question.
Very good question.
So they can't physically get here, mm-hmm. and they need to talk about a bill.
We actually have three bills that we had scheduled. And you know what? Let's have Brooke be the
weather
emergency service person.
We can certainly, if you're testifiers.
Yeah, we can certainly reschedule. In fact, I want people to have a chance to. Our interest is to have good hearing with legislators present, the public able to testify. So if we're not able to do that, we will cancel and reschedule. No question about it. So let's kind of play it by ear. See if we actually, if the storm goes around us to the south like the last one did, maybe we'll be okay. But if it doesn't, then
I know that Representative Pawlowski this morning announced that their committee meeting tomorrow morning is kind of hanging in the balance. So okay. Will, you can talk to that. But
all right,
because of that issue.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think we also, there's some early ed members who have a standing committee meeting at that time from 4 to 5:30.
Okay.
So we're double duty there.
Yeah, I know.
If I could flip myself, I gladly would for your committee, but I'm not sure that we could do that.
It's a little hard, and this is going to start to happen more and more as we get longer and longer. And, it's part of the function of the process. We take time with our bills, and then we have to get kind of squished. But I want to make sure that everything gets a proper hearing. So if the weather interferes, that's fine. I think the issue with other committees, we're just going to have to do the best we can because it's probably going to get a lot worse. We have so many committees. We'll try to check to see if there's some other times as well. In fact, if the weather's bad, Brooke will have that responsibility. And please respond to her emails about your availability as soon as you can, because then it'll help us take into consideration. And we'd rather not have you be a split personality, as you just mentioned. It's pretty hard. Okay. So we have a quorum, and I think we have minutes from the two previous meetings. I'm wondering if someone would like to check those out and provide a motion to approve the minutes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan?
Yes, I'll move the minutes from Wednesday, February 21 and Tuesday, February 27.
Okay. That motion is before us to approve the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? This motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Approved. Okay, our first bill, Representative Krantz. Representative Krantz, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you want to move your...
And committee members, I believe the intent of this is to get it passed out of this committee today and sent on to local government, because there are some implications that it may have there. So that would be the motion that I would offer at this time.
So Representative Krantz moves that House File 1205 be approved to be passed and referred to local government.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Krantz.
House File 1205 is kind of more of a insurance type of bill for homeowners. That's kind of what it boils down to. There are a lot of our homeowners and residents in this state that live in manufactured homes and manufactured home parks. And some of the, basically the background here is we have about 50,000 households making up of about 180,000 people in our state that reside in manufactured home parks. And in most cases, just to give you a feel for that, if you haven't had the opportunity to walk through a manufactured home park. But many of these people, in fact, the numbers that we have, about 80% of these are low-income families. And so making sure that these are stable communities that can sustain the growth of time and not become homeless, this is a great opportunity to provide some insurance for these families. There are currently 9 other states that require reimbursement when parks close, and so we would hopefully be looking at trying to model or catch up with some of those states. And the problem basically exists where a park, for whatever reason, a park owner decides to close a park. Then what do we do with all the residents that live there? Well, in some cases, it may be a smaller park and not as significant of a change, but it certainly is for those residents that live there. In a lot of cases, these parks are quite large. Where do all these people go? You know, we have to have a place reasonable for them to move into. So we gotta make sure that these people aren't homeless. Currently, you might say, well, what's going on right now? Currently, a lot of the cities are trying to enact ordinances to handle some of these relocation expenses. Right now, out of the over 400 cities that we have, 20 have relocation ordinances. So I think one of the positions on this might be, well, let's just wait for the cities to do this. Well, for a park that's closing and a city that doesn't have any of these relocation ordinances, that's not a very good option. So we need to be a leader at the state level in providing some stability for these homeowners. The solution basically that we're seeking is to provide relocation expenses, as in the bill 1205, for any situation where a park may close, the residents would get relocation expenses and, you know, basically not become homeless. So I think to that, that's in a sense what the bill does. If I do have some testifiers, and in fact one of them, which is a member of ours who has worked tirelessly on this area, Representative Osmond. And okay, and I'm being told that he is not able to attend here, but I know a lot of this work was done by Representative Osmond. Both 2 years ago, 4 years ago, and as far as I'm aware, he's very involved in this issue and will definitely be a part of our progression of this bill. Then I do have a couple other people on my list here of testifiers. If those who are on my list can maybe come down in this area. I have Ann Higgins, who represents the League of Minnesota Cities.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'll introduce yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ann Higgins. I work at the League of Minnesota Cities and work on housing policy issues for the League. This issue came to us after our policy development process, which we have every year, was concluded for this year. But in adopting our policies, we had some areas that we had addressed in terms of trying to retain our available existing affordable housing stock. And this seemed to be an area to address, and I have spoken with numbers of cities and with our organization of housing officials, Minnesota NARO, about this. And while I'm still getting input, it's certainly clear to me that cities think that this is a statewide policy matter that the legislature clearly has prerogative to lead on. And indeed, those cities that have had ordinances in place indicate that they have seen some successes in people not becoming at risk for homelessness. Clearly, these folks that we know are residents of our communities, they're residents just as much as anyone who's there, whether they rent or have their a single-family home on their own land. The difference is they're in a home park, and they're subject to different circumstances, many of which haven't been addressed here at the legislature for many years. And I think maybe in the future that might be something that this committee would like to look at more in depth at. But we're not here for that today. My point today is simply to say that the cities certainly have authority to adopt these ordinances. The fact that we might not adopt a reimbursement matter might is well taken from the fact that there's nothing in state law that speaks to it. So if you were to decide on this matter, it would leave us less than we are now in the middle of that discussion, which we're sometimes not the best people to reflect on. I mean, we do want our local control and our ability to do things. I know that is a fundamental part of the League's outlook on state policy. On the other hand, when it comes to the availability of affordable housing stock, it's critical. We don't have available at the local level, in most cases, housing waiting for folks who've lost their mobile home. Those folks are likely to move to a different community, maybe many, many miles from where they work. So now we've lost people who had jobs in our community and helped provide the economic activity on which our communities depend. Then we have lost the jobs that the local employer has been able to rely on folks locally to fill. So it is a loss for us overall. And, you know, if we had the best of all possible worlds and we were able to provide an available stock of affordable housing so that when folks fell on circumstances such as we're talking about here today, they could still remain in our community, I wouldn't be here. But that's not the case. So that is my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Higgins. Any questions for the witness? No, thank you. Next witness.
Okay. I have the pleasure of also introducing to you, committee, a couple of resident homeowners. I have Beverly Adrian.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'll introduce yourself, please, to the tape.
Yes, my name is Bev Adrian. I'm the former resident of Shady Lane Park, a park that closed in Bloomington, April 1st, 2006. I'm a manufactured homeowner, and I own a home that is 1,456 square feet, three bedrooms, two bathrooms, very lovely, brand new, and I was forced to move my home. It took $10,000 to move that home, and I couldn't stay in my community in Bloomington. As a result of the process of this park closing, there were 10 families that would have virtually become homeless as a result of this park closing. They were compensated for their homes, but their homes were old. They maybe were 30 years old, and they got $3,000 for them. It wasn't enough to afford them into an apartment, and they didn't have the income to sustain the going rates of the apartments. Manufactured housing is a very respectable lifestyle choice. It's not subsidized housing. It is affordable housing. Unfortunately, we have lost 451 homes since the year 2000. Not every community has a relocation compensation ordinance. Fortunately, Bloomington did. As a result of our park closing, five more communities have passed an ordinance since 2006. But we are asking you to do the right thing. Help these folks whose parks are closing be compensated for the move. It's the right thing to do. But it's not enough. It's not enough. And this leads into the second bill, and I'm going to address it just very briefly because it hasn't been introduced formally, and that is the first right of refusal, allowing park owners to have the first option to purchase that land and become landowners as well as homeowners. That's the extra next step. There are lenders who are willing to help finance that, nonprofit developers. This is the direction in preservation of affordable housing that I see as critical to helping lower income people, Vietnam vets, senior citizens, single family, parent families, maintain their affordable housing stock. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Adrian. Any questions for the witness? Representative Schumper.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just one quick question for Ms. Adrian. Did your community compensate you then for the moving costs?
Yes, I was compensated. My house cost $10,000 to move.
Okay. Good.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Adrian, what was the reason for the closing of the... Why did Bloomington close the... and was there any type of... effort made on the part of the city to give you any options?
Ms. Adrian?
One of the phrases that I've heard through this process is a better use of the land, building condos. Condos that start at about $200,000 are not affordable housing for the folks that were being displaced. The city unfortunately was very happy to see a better use of the land instituted in 5 acres of prime real estate in Bloomington. 5 acres held about 70 homes. There were only 45 left at the time of the closing. The city was happy to get rid of us. Very happy. I even heard the statement that some people can't afford to live in Bloomington anymore. And how arrogant is that?
Madam Chair, Ms. Adrian, did the city give you any options, like maybe saying when we get these condos moved, put up, that you could move into one of them?
That was not an option offered to us.
Thank you.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Adrian?
That's right.
You mentioned affordable housing, and I think the League of Ms. Higgins was up here, talked about affordable housing from the city's perspective. You're talking about some of the conflicting interests of cities and homeowners. My question is simply, where in the geography of our state are there jurisdictions that would allow a new manufactured home park to start right now? Is there any city, is there any place in our state that would in their zoning ordinance, would allow that to occur right now?
Would you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you very much. My name is Margaret Kaplan, and I'm the staff attorney with All Parks Alliance for Change. And I just wanted to answer a question that's a little bit technical in nature. Really, the barrier to new parks being developed is, particularly in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, availability of land that is affordable to do such developments. Currently on the books, there is a law that says that if a piece of land is zoned for, I think if it's zoned for multifamily development, that manufactured housing is a conditional use. So you can get a conditional use permit to put manufactured housing in communities if you have multifamily zoning. But really it comes down to expense more than anything else. I also wanted to kind of go back to a point that was brought up before, and that is that, you know, regardless of what cities feel about an individual park, really the decision to close a manufactured home park is a decision not made by any city. It's a decision that's made by the property owner, by the owner of the land underneath the homes that are owned by the individual resident. So it's not cities that are making decisions to close manufactured home parks. It's individual park owners and individual developers who determine that they want a different use of this property.
Representative Eastman.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that answer, but I guess the point that I was going to is that if affordable housing is something that cities desire, and there are clearly land acquisitions that are available, I'm sure that could just as easily put a manufactured home park on it as to build freestanding affordable housing units. But it seems that the zoning rules in most jurisdictions would not allow that. And so I find it a little interesting here that the cities are here saying that they want this compensation to be happening by the owners, but the cities, in fact, are the ones that are basically eliminating manufactured home parks from existence. How many new manufactured home parks have been developed in our state in the last 5 years?
To the best of my knowledge, none. But I just kind of want to come back to a point, though. I mean, even if new manufactured home parks were being developed, when an existing park closes, you're still going to have individual homeowners who aren't going to be able to afford to move their homes and aren't going to receive any reimbursement for the value of their homes. So having new manufactured home parks developed isn't necessarily going to help those individual homeowners escape homelessness.
Madam Chair.
I
appreciate the answer, but I would beg to disagree, because it's very difficult to move a manufactured home if you have no place to move it.
That is correct.
And if there are no new manufactured home opportunities being developed, there eventually will be no place to move it. And so basically the home becomes a lemon. and to quite frankly, to hold the manufactured park owner responsible for that, I think there is an equity issue involved. I think that the responsibility for that should spread a little bit farther than just the park owner, when cities and zoning jurisdictions are basically zoning them out of existence. And so I think a problem is being created here, and this bill is forcing the solution to that problem onto the manufactured park owners, the park owners, who really are almost like the victim in this case. If they want to sell their property, the costs are basically going to disappear. I mean, the value of that property is going to disappear if all of their dollars are going to have to go to relocate current residents who have no place to go. So, I mean, I think we have a multifaceted problem here that this bill does not really address the entire issue. And I guess I would like to have the author maybe comment on that, if you would.
Representative Cran?
Yeah, I think, Madam Chair and Representative Eastland, I think you're thinking of it in terms of when a park closes, a manufactured home park resident would move from a park to another park. And that isn't in this here. It's basically to give them relocation expenses. So they may move to another affordable housing situation, whatever that solution may be, but it's the dollars, it's to compensate the value of their home into moving them into another. It doesn't have to be from, you know, a manufactured home to a manufactured home. It could be any other housing solution that they can find. But it is to provide the relocation expenses. I mean, I would phrase it in another way. I mean, in this situation, if we have redevelopment of any kind, I mean, it kind of borders on the idea of eminent domain, where if somebody comes in and says, well, we want to build whatever, a theme park, right, in your block where you live, you want compensation for your home and the land. Well, you're going to get that. In this situation where we have manufactured home, I mean, they own the home. They just don't own the land. And so if there's some new vision for development, whatever that may be, if that's the end result, all we're doing is looking for some insurance for these people who own the home. You know, let's give them a break here. So I think that's the intent of the bill.
Representative Peterson?
Madam Chair, can I respond to that? And I understand that, I guess, but my question is when the options for preserving the home are diminishing, then the costs of reimbursement for whatever the person loses is increasing. And to place that entire burden onto the park owner seems to be, I think, inappropriate, because there's a host of other reasons that are driving this issue. And if cities and zoning jurisdictions are part of that issue, then they should be participating in this as well.
Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I always wanted to, appreciated Ms. Adrian speaking on the Bloomington case. And I think I want to be careful that we don't always paint the cities as the villain. I have witnessed three closings in Bloomington. One of them is on 494, which now houses a Walmart. The owner was a slum landlord. There was another one at Lindale on 494 that is now an Acura auto dealership. The owner was a slum landlord. And in those situations, that's right before Bloomington got its ordinance passed. And what was happening is some of these mobile homes, if you call them that, manufactured housing, were 30 years old. How do you fix the bathroom of a 30-year-old, cheaply built aluminum trailer that was parked in a lot? And I know that's what we were seeing when we saw the first ones closed. It was just deplorable. And what was happening is the people would come to the park, and the park would hang out a sign saying, home for sale. And so somebody would come in and buy it. Well, they bought it from the owner of the park, of the lot. And he said, you can buy this, Ms. Lark, for $500 a month. What you didn't realize when you agreed to that you were setting up a 10-year conditional sales contract on something that's probably worth $2,000 at best. And he's just charged you $10,000, $12,000 over the next years. And there's never a way you'll ever get out of it. And when you finally decide you're going to vacate and go to another place, he buys it back from you at a nominal amount of money, and you just have to move on. And when Indian Spar's closed, we couldn't move those units. We physically could not pick them up and move them, and they couldn't move to a new park because they would not meet the code requirement of the new park. I mean, they simply didn't meet the code. And in these parks, the city had no jurisdiction to enforce any kind of a code on these airstreams that were parked and connected to utilities. And so if the airstream got really beat up and run down, it was just too bad. And so this is a very, very complex compound, and all of the first, second, third ring suburbs are faced with this dilemma. And then the owner eventually decides that they want to get out, and they've been in owner of that park for 25 years. And in the case where Ms. Adrian was, I understand that park owner finally retired. He finally sold it to another park owner who then came and got in conflict with the other residents because he tried to enforce some kind of orderly living conditions around the remainder, the sheds, the porches, the garbage cans, everything. I mean, all that stuff went on. Several of them were able to move, and she said they got down to 44 units. And at that point, the rest of them, they really couldn't be moved. There was no place for them to go. So something needs to be done. I understand that. But let's be careful that we don't villainize somebody in the process. And the villains are not the cities. If you want to build a new park, you can build them in many communities, but you will build them to standards that are much better with paved curb and gutter and streets and pads and utilities. And the dilemma is that those who are living in the ghetto of a Bloomington home cannot move that unit to the new parks because the new parks can't accept them. So it's compound.
Thank you. Representative Schumper?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Representative Peterson, I thought your explanation was really very educational, but it seems to me that Representative Kranz's bill addresses a lot of the concerns you just articulated, and so I think we should be supportive of this bill. I certainly am, and I have a slew of mobile home parks in my district, to be honest. I did want to ask Ms. Adrian, can you tell us, if you know, what the park eventually sold for?
Ms. Adrian?
The current owner sold the park for $2 million. He bought it 4 years prior to that for $1 million.
And so the person who actually closed it got $2 million?
That's correct.
Because I was just doing some calculating, Madam Chair, and if every homeowner got compensated the same as Ms. Adrian, $10,000 times 70, that's $700,000. So the guy who sold it in the end still walked away with $1.3 million, even if he...
I was the highest compensated person because I had the newest home and the largest.
Okay.
Right.
Madam Chair.
Please. Sure.
I am in support of the bill, but I just you'll need to have some background on it. And the purchaser was Life. It's a co-op. It's a senior housing co-op. And again, I don't want to villainize, make a villain of the seller of the property. I mean, he came into a worse situation and held on for four more years. At least those people in that four-year period had a little more runway to plan their future than it was going to be when the original family was going to sell it.
Yeah, I appreciate the conversation on this, and I just want to address a couple of things. I know that there are some situations where the park owners aren't as mindful as the residents would like them to be. But I have the privilege of representing, you know, six manufactured home parks in my community, and they're wonderful. In fact, some of the best nights last fall, door knocking, were Friday nights, walking through. They're all home, they're out, they're talking with each other. I mean, it was alive. And in some cases, even for the record, if I would have accepted every beer that they graciously offered me, I'm not sure if I'd have found my way out of the park. And that speaks to the kind of people that I think we're talking about. And the owners that I represent have done a marvelous job with their parks. In fact, I proudly say in most cases, 4 out of 6 of those parks, I would consider moving into myself. So, I mean, that's kind of the background that I bring this bill, and I see it as not an emergency situation. I see it as a situation where we can provide some peace of mind to people who have a home and are unsure. And you remember that, you know, the Viking Stadium was a real proposal that was in my district. And there were a lot of manufactured home parks who, you know, the real estate dollar signs started to flash in front of a lot of owners' eyes. And it was a concern. Now, a lot of my park owners went beyond their expectations, or beyond the park's expectations, in trying to quell some of that fear. But it was real. And it brought to my eyes just the need for some stability for these families. And they really are. I mean, there is a diverse group in there. They're young families. They're senior citizens. There's a lot of veterans that live in these homes. And the community feel in these things are just, it's exciting. So I just, that's kind of the intent of this. And I do want to address Representative Eastland's question. I think the removal, if you look in lines 2-5 to 2-10, the relocation of some of these units, if they are immovable, and you know, statistics or data tells me that you're lucky if you can move 1 in 10. I mean, either they were intended in one time to be moved, but no longer. I mean, you could back a truck up and you just end up with a frame. And so they really aren't necessarily movable, but so the relocation would go to the market value of that home. And unfortunately, for a lot of residents, they understand that what they've paid for it, and it depreciates so fast that, you know, that's not necessarily a benefit either. So
I'd like to get to the opposition, and then we can, Representative Eastland, I'll put you on next.
I just respond to that.
All right. If you can make it short, because we have another bill that we heard, and I want to make sure that we get the opposition to this bill.
I don't disagree with you at all. I have some mobile home parks, manufactured home parks, I just got to call them, in my district. And, in fact, I think I have one that's probably rated the top one or two of the state of Minnesota. I mean, it has all the bells and whistles that we're talking about. But, I mean, just take that case for an example where the homes are nice. If for some reason that manufactured home park owner would want to sell it, and if there was some reason why they wanted to use that land for something else, those homes are all very valuable. But there's no place for them to move.
Okay,
And I think that's the issue that I'm concerned about is, and we're putting all that cost and all that responsibility onto the homeowner, and I'm not sure that that's an appropriate place for it all to go.
Okay, Representative Eastland, I'm going to ask you just to make it short here because we do want to hear from the opposition, and I think you've made that point a couple times. So, I believe the first person is Scott Lund. Is that right? Then I have Mark Brenner and Mark Lambert. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Mark Lambert.
Mark Lambert.
Order,
okay.
I'm going to be first. Scott Lund will be second. I think Mark Bruner. Madam Chair, for clarification, how much time do I have?
We have about 10 minutes for all three of you, so if you can kind of share that.
All three of you. Well, unfortunately, I have an attorney background, so I trust you can appreciate my sensitivity on the time.
Okay.
Mark Lambert, I'm an attorney. I'm also a community owner, and it's also my birthday, so you guys have to be nice to me.
Happy birthday.
I had a little card from my daughter this morning that brought tears to my eyes. A little 4-year-old wrote me a little card. Had her sister, had her other sister, who were 7 and 8. They had beautiful heads of hair, had mom with a beautiful head of hair. I had one line. I asked mom, I said, Terry, where's my hair? And she said, Dad, you don't have any. So anyway, listen, I am so happy to be here and so happy to have these discussions with you. This is a very, very difficult, very, very heart-wrenching issue for everybody here. Residents, community owners, municipalities who are happy to see show today, the introduction, the bill authors, nobody takes this lightly. And as you'll see, I've got a couple of ways that I can approach it. I've got a lot of history here with this. I've actually represented communities that have closed and went through your existing statute. I've represented communities that have decided not to close for fear of the effort that it's going to require to go through a closing. And so they're still operating when they probably, quite frankly, shouldn't be. So what we need here is more than anything a good set of heads to really look at this issue, to not make rational decisions, and to really try to help solve what's really becoming a state problem and a national problem and is existing currently a local problem, and it's a resident concern, and it's a community owner concern as well. The real challenge that we have right now, and there is an existing statute in place, and I'll spend a little bit of time with you if you'd like me to explain how that works, but there is an existing statute. The problem with that existing statute is, on the best level that you can possibly put it, it's an us and it's a them. Okay, there's only one pocket that's involved, and it's a park owner's pocket, and there are residents who, for whatever the reason, are being asked to relocate their homes. And the procedure that's in existing state statute today says, okay, community owner, whatever your reason for closing, you need to come to a public hearing much like this, to a group of local city councilors or to town supervisors or whoever it is, and explain to those people how you're closing your park, why you're closing your park, and what are you doing for your residents. And at that hearing, the people have who are the supervisors have a couple of decisions to make. Number one is the community owner really doing what they're supposed to do in terms of trying to relocate those residents? Are they doing everything they can? Or are they, frankly, being jerks? And I think we heard about a couple of those. Are they trying to relocate the residents? Are they making a good faith effort? At the end of the day, the existing statute gives that authority one choice. How much is going to come out of the community owner's proceeds in order to satisfy the obligations of the residents? And so the real inherent challenge that we have here today, and it's kind of a constitutional challenge too, and I'll talk about that in the few minutes I have left, but the real challenge is, how do you, as a municipality, say, okay, property owner one, park owner, you have to give up proceeds that you get from the sale of your property to give to residents who are legitimate, you know, tenants and have some rights in that property, and you ask the municipality to make that decision as to how much it should be. And I guess my challenge for you today is, it's too limiting. It's inherently wrong because it creates a one-pocket source. And I think if we really dig down in and amongst ourselves, we can find that maybe there are some other sources. I'm a little bit off script, so I'm going to wander a bit, but I represented Shakopee in their adoption of their park closing ordinance. I heard testimony that there are about 20 ordinances. I think that's probably correct from my rough knowledge, out of 400 communities. I represented Shakopee, and I really want to laud Shakopee, because when we sat down and we said, look, you have one community, we know it might close someday, let's have an ordinance. Residents wanted it. We worked with Shakopee, and Shakopee reached down in and they said, okay, number one is, you know, let's find a fair number, and the number was 20%, I believe they used, or it might even been a little bit less. But even more importantly, they said, look, first we're going to try TIF and see if we can find TIF. And if we can't find TIF, we're going to look for economic development incentives. And if we can't find economic development incentives, you know what, we think enough of this issue, we're going to go into our general fund to help the residents relocate. So I guess my challenge is here, let's stop making this an us versus them. Residents on one side, community owners on the other side. This is an inherent problem. The community owners didn't do anything wrong. We bought a community that was built 40, 50 years old. We're operating it. We're doing the level best that we can. The residents didn't do anything wrong. Their homes are just simply getting older. Some of them are functionally obsolete. How do you repair a 30-year-old manufactured home? So, you know, the issue here today oughtn't be, let's take from one side, shift over to the other. The issue really ought to be, how do we create some funding sources to make sure that we respect private property rights and we're not simply pulling funds away from people who are doing their best to run a business and pay residents who have legitimate concerns about the future of their communities. I'm getting the wind-up sign. My concern is, when you look at the bill that's in place, it doesn't offer us any opportunity to work with the residents. The bill that's currently offered simply says, look, residents have the opportunity to take a buyout, whatever the cost, it's going to be paid by the residents or by the community owners. So my first concern is, it ignores a cap. In almost all of the 20 municipalities that have adopted it, there was a cap in place. That cap was constitutionally challenged. It was in Bloomington. It went up to the state Supreme Court. State Supreme Court said 20% cap is fair. Okay, so there's at least some judicial precedence out there for 20%. My concern is the current bill doesn't address the cap whatsoever, and I think you could create scenarios, specifically in outstate, where the 30%, 40%, 50%, I think even maybe the example of 700,000 begins to exceed the 20% cap. And so I think you have a constitutional issue there. The other challenge, I guess, is that you need to create a system, or we need to create a system that frankly addresses the issue of the older homes. You have two types of communities in Minnesota, as many of you know. You have the metro communities where you have a high dollar sale price for property. In those cases, you have an individual who buys a community for $1 million, sells it for $2 million. He has $1 million to work with in order to fund, in a sense, the relocation for the residents. The real challenge that you have in 14 out of the 18 communities in here are outstate. People aren't paying $2 million for outstate community parks. A lot of these parks are just simply closing the door, shutting them up, and saying, residents, go away. So as you address this issue, be very, very mindful. The fat, happy, and sassy ones are the metro parks where we have a big dollar because of land value and we can do things. That's only a few. The real challenge is here, what are you going to do about Wells, Minnesota? What are you going to do about Olivia? Because nobody's paying $2 million for communities in those areas. So, do you have any questions?
Lemon, I think I want to hear from each of the witnesses because we're getting short on time. Thank you very much and happy birthday. I think Mr. Brenner. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Bruner. I'm the president of the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. And follow on Mr. Lampert's comments, the association has this similar concerns that were just expressed insofar as an opportunity here to really, if you will, address a serious issue, especially in greater Minnesota, as it relates to the values of manufactured home parks that may close and even what would be available to pay relocation costs. One of the things that we've been looking at as an industry the past couple of years is what other states have done to address this problem. Last year I chaired a national industry task force looking at park closures, and it's clearly an issue in every state in terms of economic development and closures. Very few states have anything whatsoever on the books to relate, covering or dealing with park closures, maybe seven or eight states overall. Minnesota actually has one of the better statutes right now in place to deal with the issue. But what's really lacking, and it's been alluded to earlier, is a way to bring parties together and talk about fair compensation for residents that are forced to relocate, not in a way that's linked to the purchase price or the acquisition price of the property when it's closed. What the state of Florida has done, the state of Arizona has done, is to create a trust fund that is created through payments made by the park that's closing and the owner on a per home basis, by the park owner in other ways, as well as residents in a small way in terms of annually. And then there is the Housing Finance Authorities in those states determine what the relocation amount should be, what the value should be if homes can't be relocated. And we feel that this would be a much better, a more comprehensive approach to dealing with this issue, especially when you get beyond the Twin Cities area. And there are 1,200 licensed manufactured home parks in the state of Minnesota. And of that total, only about 70 or 80 are in the Twin Cities. So when we're talking about multi-million-dollar redevelopment, we're really talking about the Twin Cities area, and then the balance of these properties really won't be helped in a way that they should by the bill. We'd be more than willing to work with the author on a proposal. We did draft some language. We actually only saw the bill a few days ago and tried to pull together some of what we saw in the state of Arizona and Florida, and would hope that going forward that we could maybe more comprehensively address this problem and take away issues of takings and that kind of thing from the equation. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Mr. Brenner. Mr. Lund, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, representatives, I wear a couple of hats. I am the Mayor of Fridley for the past 6 years, and I'm here to testify as a recently past owner of Rightway Mobile Home Repair, which services the manufactured housing industry for the past 34 years.
Will you give your name to the table?
Scott Lund.
Thank you.
My points today are very brief, Madam Chair and representatives. I just wanted to give you a flavor of four persons like myself in the industry attempting to do relocation for these displaced owners. And I mean no disrespect to any of the homeowners that might be present here today or that may hear my testimony relating to their homes. I think one of the inherent issues or one of the problems, what is problematic that's been briefly addressed here today, is the fact that the homes cannot be relocated cost effectively, and I think that poses a large problem for the property owners. Certainly I and my portion of the industry as a service company would love to relocate more of those homes rather than in the case of Shady Lane or Shady Oaks, that most of those homes were demolished on site. Not only were they not relocatable or not acceptable to other newer parks, and there was some vacancies, although they would have to move out of the community because there wasn't anything readily available that close. So many of them were demolished on site because they were not even transportable to a demolition dump. And we do that because it is less costly if they are transportable to a dump facility. Many of them were demolished right on site because of the no axles, no hitches were cut off, because of room additions, substandard construction, just the apparent age of so many of those units. So the property has become obsolete as well because the infrastructure is in poor condition at best in many cases. So that's where I see a lot of these older parks that are obsolete needing many thousands, if not millions of dollars worth of infrastructure repair, and that has a foregone conclusion of why these parks, these older ones anyways, are going away. As to the space availability, I do see that there is space in virtually every metro park right now. New construction is not occurring because of cost of land acquisition, because of the demand is not there. The mobile home industry has also had a severe slump in sales, just like the rest of the real estate market. The affordability is seemingly going away from mobile homes because of other state statutes, and the federal government under the HUD regulations is in rulemaking, and final rulemaking is coming yet this spring. Another problem that needs to be addressed in relocation, that it is becoming more and more expensive now as the state and federal government moves towards permanent foundations, which is going to add several thousands of dollars, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 at minimum to putting permanent foundations under these homes, whereas in the past mobile homes in parks were set on the ground and therefore subjected to some frost heaving problems. But those things need to be addressed as well as the cost, the inherent cost of these, this affordability of mobile homes is quickly diminishing. And I just wanted to let this committee know that from my standpoint, I see a lot of benefits for some of these people. I've talked to many of these residents that have been very thankful of being able to get an expense for their home and or relocation costs. Now, what happens to them in their lives afterwards, I don't follow them, so I'm not sure, and maybe there's some persons that can enlighten you as to where they move on to from there. But in many cases, those homes are not saleable. A licensed dealer cannot even offer to sell, let alone sell, many of those manufactured homes because they do not fit under any code anymore. They've become obsolete.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Lund.
Yeah.
We'll take a few questions from members on the Representative Peterson.
A quick question. I heard Mr. Lambert talk about this bill didn't have a cap. And then, Mr. Bruner, you talked about Florida having a trust. So is the word cap and trust amounts, are those synonymous, or help me understand what's being suggested?
I think they're two different concepts, to be frank with you. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Lambert.
I think they're two different concepts. I think the fund is one where there are certain parameters that are established in the Florida ordinance and in the Arizona ordinance that requires community owners to pay X dollars, I think it's $3,000 per unit towards the fund. I think the residents are asked or required through either tax assessment, some de minimis amount, $5 per 10,000 or something like that per year, to contribute into the fund so that the fund grows. I think in Florida's case they were generous in that the state actually contributed $500,000 from its general fund.
to start the fund, if you will, so that there was something there. But I understand that that may be difficult in our climate here. We hope that the fund would be self-funding and that we could get it up and running as we go. Any closing takes up to 9 months in order for it to happen. So in that time period, we envision that that it would be able to get underway. The cap itself just strictly deals with one pocket when it's parked to resident.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have, I know we're short on time, and so I'm kind of making maybe a judgment call here. I do have one other witness who came all the way to testify, and I'd like to give her a minute or two to address the committee, and then I have like less than a minute to wrap this up,
right,
if that would work. I realize we're short on time. So at this time, I'd like to introduce or have Mary Hamilton come up.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, just to, if we could, I think there's a handout here that puts some background on some of the other states that have put together some solutions to this. In particular, I think, you know, as Representative Eastland was talking about, there shouldn't be one side against the other. And I think this brings to the floor a proposal that hopefully that can be incorporated, if not in this committee, then considered by some of the members and by the author, that we could actually alleviate some of this.
Are you holding the staying amendment, which was dropped on us as this committee began?
And Madam Chair, this is, yeah, and, but this is not an, I would not offer this as an amendment.
No, and it cannot be offered as an amendment.
Right.
There's plenty of time. We have a 24-hour rule. I'm very flexible. If we'd even gotten it earlier this morning, we got it as we walked in here. So we're not going to consider that, and I'd like to not actually... this is going to local government. You're welcome to pass it out,
okay,
but it's not going to be a matter of discussion. So if people want
right.
to have it, that's fine, but we're not considering that amendment.
And it's not intended as that matter.
Right.
This is just a point of information.
Right. Okay. I guess, you know, I'm fine with that, but I don't want to get diverted. We're going to vote on this in about within the next 5 minutes. We've got another bill on the floor, so as long as it's not become does not become a topic of discussion, I'm fine with that. Representative Stevenson, you're welcome to have the page pass that out if that understanding is clear.
Sure.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Mary Hamilton. I live in the city of Anoka in the Woodland Mobile Home Court. I am a proud member of the Woodland Court Resident Association, and I was elected to serve on your steering committee a few months ago. I am here today to support House File 1205. We have lived in our park for at least 20 years. This is our home and hopefully will remain our home. Over the years, many improvements have been made to the home. When adding up the total cost of the mobile home and improvements over the years, that adds up to quite a large sum of money. This is our investment for our living. Fortunately, our city passed an ordinance which guarantees compensation for residents in Anoka. I strongly believe there should be a change to the state law to protect all mobile homeowners should their parks close at any time for any reason. We have worked hard, just the same as stick-built homeowners. If a stick-built homeowner loses their home to redevelopment, the owners are guaranteed compensation. We as residents want fairness, equal rights, no discrimination, and fair protection. Manufactured homeowners deserve the same protection as stick-built homeowners when it comes to redevelopment. Any resident having purchased a mobile home should be compensated for their having to move. If there is no compensation, we as homeowners lose what we have paid for through the years and could become homeless. This includes both adults and children. The state law guarantees nothing to help out misplaced residents if the park closes. This needs to change. That is why we are counting on the state legislature, you, our elected officials, to pass this bill. This bill is fair to any developer who may come in to buy the property. He would know up front before he purchases the property what his responsibilities are with the residents of the park if it should close. The same is true of any park owner also. This park ordinance is not anti-development. It simply ensures that new development happens without a social crisis in the state. This is affordable housing for us. There is no other option as affordable to live. Also, there would be no burden on local governments of families knocking on their door for compensation. It will cost the taxpayers nothing. There have been 20 cities who have passed park closing ordinances to protect their citizens and residents of the parks. But there are hundreds of thousands of people who still have no protection. Please pass House File 1205 for the protection of all residents. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We've got a couple of people to this witness. Representative Schumper and Representative McMahon. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick point for all the members here. To the last three sentences on this bill, which are current statute, the municipality already has the power to spread the closing costs among various parties. So they could get some of the costs covered by the purchaser and even by themselves, which is contrary to, I think, at least what I heard, thought I heard Mr. Lampert say.
Representative McMahon.
Madam Chair, my question is not to the testifier, it's okay. To the bill.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And the bill is before us. Some final comments, Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to really thank Representative Kranz for bringing this forward. This is a huge issue. What I would ask, Madam Chair, we need to do something here. And I would feel much better if we could bring the two sides together, and if we need a lock them in a room, Madam Chair. Maybe that's what we need to do. But we need to find a solution. There's folks here that there's examples where they've been held hostage and it hasn't been fair. But I think we have to look at the reality. We've got to do something that doesn't end up with a park owner keeping it open and maybe in a dilapidated condition and encouraging the people to gradually move out and get no compensation. Almost just in, I can just picture this in my mind. I guess, Madam Chair, I would ask that we lay this over, bring the parties together and find a solution. And Representative Kranz, if they don't come forward in a real way to work with you to find a solution, then I think we do the in your face, we're going to do it to you. But I just think that listening to the testimony on both sides, I think we need to find a solution. And this is the Housing Finance Committee. This decision should be made here. I hate to see it be going to local government negotiated there. These folks signed up for this committee to deal with these kinds of issues. And, Madam Chair, I guess I would just like to ask the author if that's a possibility. This is an important and, you know, I just think it's a great opportunity for you, Representative Kranz, to reach out to everyone.
Representative Kranz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative McNamara. Right now, as it states, in fact, you began my closing remarks to this bill. We are looking for solutions with this bill, and I think introducing this in its form and getting it through this committee will begin us on our way to that process. I don't know if some of the things have been addressed. I don't believe that my bill in any way counteracts the decision by the Supreme Court on the cap. So I don't know that we're necessarily addressing, I mean, having an issue there. I do know a couple of things. I know Representative Osmond is supporting this bill as it is the way it is. I do know also that at 5:30 last night, I was spoken to on behalf of park owners that there may be an amendment that would deal with some of this stuff. At that time, And their lobbyists can vouch for this, I am very open to working through this process and working with them to try to find a solution. However, I'm not interested at this time to lay this over. I would like to get this through this committee today. So I guess that's kind of where I'm at on this bill. So I would once again renew my motion to pass this out of it and to send it to the local government.
The motion is before us to pass this bill to local government, where there will be a chance for a lot more discussion. Representative Severson.
Do you anticipate that this bill will be coming back to this committee then?
I'm not sure. I think, Representative Kranz, are you sure?
Sure. Yeah, I guess I don't have my crystal ball in front of me right now, but if there are some issues raised in local government, we'll look at it.
And Madam Chair, to that point, I think because this is the Housing Finance Agency, I think I would consider that this would be, you know, something that we would take another look at, hopefully after it's been worked over a little bit. But that's your decision, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, the bill is before us. That House File 1205 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Local Government Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is passed and is re-referred to the local government. Thank you very much.
Thank you, committee.
Okay. I'm going to get to our next bill, which deals with manufactured homes as well. Yeah. Representative Rowe, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We have 25 minutes here. We'll see how far we can get.
Okay. I'd like to move House File.
I'd like to move House File 1301 to pass and to be re-referred to local government.
Local government, okay.
I have a couple of testifiers that will be up here soon with me, Margaret Lund and Amy Frederville. You want to just come on up now?
Maybe in the interest of time, if you just come on up and make a little panel here, that might make it work a little better.
And then I'll have a couple of homeowners that will also say a couple of things. But
maybe the papers can help with the chairs around there, and we'll get everybody.
Well, but I'll keep our comments a couple minutes, and we have some opposition, and give them equal time. Could you come on up to the microphone, please? Madam Chair, members of the committee, we've spent a good deal of time talking already about the challenges for mobile home parks and residents. In particular, these are some of our most affordable housing stock in the state of Minnesota. Many of them are imperiled. 13 members of this committee have mobile home parks in your districts. Myself, I have 62. Thousands of families, literally, living in mobile home parks. And with affordable housing being such an issue for so many of our communities, in fact, Bemidji Day at the Capitol, you saw our beautiful sweaters down here last week. The Chamber of Commerce picked this as one of their five key issues, affordable housing. It's a huge issue for all of us. House File 1301 essentially says right now, if a mobile home park is closed or converted, theoretically there's a first right of refusal for the tenants. Now there's a year window that this has to happen. So in practice, it doesn't happen, has yet to happen in the state of Minnesota. And what we're asking for is first right of refusal for tenants to purchase the property, and this is whenever the use is changed or title is transferred, with the exception of for family members or partnerships. In addition, we're extending the period of time. We'd like to extend the period of time in which the financing could become available for homeowners from 45 to 90 days, and also establish an incentive, capital gains tax forgiveness for mobile home owners on the sale of the property if they do, in fact, transfer the ownership to the tenants. And I think we recognize there's some financial challenges for park owners that you've heard, and the intention is to provide some financial incentive for them to transfer ownership. So with that, I'm going to there's more to tell, but I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers. And Tim Thompson from the Housing Preservation Project will be our first testifier.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tim Thompson. I'm the president of the Housing Preservation Project, which is a public interest law firm that works on preserving and expanding the supply of affordable housing. The discussion we have heard so far this morning, I think, points up the enormous distress that is created by the closure of a manufactured home park. And I think it points up even more the importance of this bill. We struggle in Minnesota to meet the gap for the need on affordable housing. We commit substantial public resources. We see the gap between supply and demand continue to grow. It makes it all the more critical that we hang on to the resources that we've got. And if you can take state law and you can align it in a way that encourages more preservation, there's a huge payoff. And that's what we're hoping to accomplish with this bill today. I know a lot of the members are familiar with the parks in their district and what a critical resource it is for the elderly and young families. But what I think is also really striking about this issue is that this is a resource which manages to create affordable housing for low and moderate income people without a dime of public money. It creates ownership opportunities. And if you look at the total supply of units in manufactured home parks, it exceeds the supply of federally subsidized housing in the state of Minnesota. It's an enormous resource, but the problem is it is really at risk these days. We have seen, between 2000 and 2006, 14 parks in the state close, nearly 500 units. And that's what we have to get a handle on. The problem with the existing right of first refusal law, it's a great idea. The notion, of course, is that when an owner is going to close a park in connection with a sale, the residents have the right to step forward, meet the purchase price, buy the park themselves, and keep it open. The problem, there are two problems, essentially. One is it doesn't work as well as it could, and it does not apply in all situations where it should apply. And that's what we're trying to address with this bill. I might also mention, representatives discussed the fact that one of the problems with many of these parks is that they may be dilapidated. There are problems with the infrastructure. We are among a number of organizations that are trying to figure out how to promote more resident ownership of these parks. And in virtually every instance, the organizations that are trying to do this want to acquire these parks with the residents in connection with a plan that will address the infrastructure needs and, where possible, upgrade the homes. So the point is, by making this law apply more widely, we are improving these valuable assets that we've already got. I would simply say it's really critical to expand the time period from 45 to 90 days. I know Margaret Lund will explain more why that is necessary. And in our view, you really could use a lot more time, but we saw that as a reasonable compromise with the owner's desire to not have to deal with excessive delays. And the other critical thing is, right now, the time where this law applies is when a park closes in connection with a sale or when a park closes within 1 year of the sale. All other cases where parks close, it doesn't help. It doesn't apply. And so it's really critical to make sure it applies wherever a park closes. In addition, we think in order to get a long-range handle on this problem, we would be better off with more parks in the hands of the residents themselves. So if you provide the same right of first refusal whenever a park is sold, in the right circumstances, we can get more of these parks in the hands of the residents. The owners will still get their fair market value, so we think that's a good public policy outcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we'll have questions at the end of the testifiers. That's okay. Okay. Next, Margaret Lund from North Country Cooperative Development Fund.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Margaret Lund. I'm the Executive Director of North Country Cooperative Development Fund and the President of North Country Cooperative Federal Credit Union. We're what's called a Community Development Loan Fund, and we're the organizer, developer, and we've been the financer of the two manufactured home park co-ops in Minnesota that exist today. And what I think you've seen, what we have here is a really odd situation. We have people who own their own home, and they don't own the land. So you have two sets of property owners, and they're literally right next to each other, and their rights are not often identical. And so what you get is a situation over and over and over again where there's fundamental conflict, and all too often the rights of the homeowners, that the situation operates to the detriment of the homeowners. So what we're looking for, and what we've seen in other states that have a lot of resident-owned cooperatives, is that the situation, which has evolved historically for any number of reasons, and it's nobody's fault, but I think we can all see it's not working real well, and it's broken in some ways, and how can we fix it and keep this housing? And the way that we think to fix it is through resident-owned co-ops, where people who now don't own the land, they may have a 30-day lease on the land where they could own that land underneath their homes, just like everybody else, in perpetuity, invest in those homes, invest in the communities, and know that they have a stable place in that community. You've heard from the testimony. People live in parks. These are not transient housing. 20, 30, 40, we have a member of a park. 1955, the guy moved in. I mean, these are people who are vested in the community, and they want to stay here, yet they live in a 30-day lease on their land. So what we're looking for in this situation is what's the answer, right? What's the answer? And we think the answer is resident ownership of the land through a co-op. And what's important about this bill, I think, is that it uses natural market occurrences and transitions to fix the situation over time. So it doesn't mandate. Nobody's forced to sell. It's a park owner would decide to sell, and then the legislation would kick in. So it doesn't mandate someone sells. It doesn't predetermine a price. It uses, again, natural, a market price with the market price for that, just like any other buyer, except that the buyer is the resident. And that's the important thing. It still gives 90 days for residents, with the help of organizations like ours, to put together a comparable offer so that the owner gets the same price they would have gotten from another seller. What we need the 90 days for is to do the due diligence that any prudent property purchaser would do. We do environmental studies. We do what's called a physical capital needs assessment. The infrastructure in these parks is often quite old. As an organization, as a nonprofit, if we're going to encourage residents to buy that, they need to know, you know, how the sewer is doing, what's going on with that. We have to put money aside in the project to fix these things as they go on. So what we're looking for is really a stable long-term solution, and it takes a little bit of time. I don't think 90 days is not an outrageous amount of time in a real estate transaction. There's other states have similar legislation with as much as 120 or in one case 180 days for residents to do this due diligence and find financing. So we did really try to think about the balance of what's going to impinge on someone's right, you know, of the transaction going forward versus the time that you need to take to really do the job that anyone, any prudent buyer needs to do. And residents are prudent buyers. They need to be treated. They need to be given the time to do that kind of examination. And one of the things I just wanted to point out, I mean, there are other states that have that. In the state of New Hampshire, they've been doing resident-owned manufactured home park communities for 20 years. There's over 80 parks in New Hampshire, and they work well. Residents can, they can buy their parks, they can do the deals, they can operate them, and they work really well. And because of New Hampshire, there's been this historic experience with it. There's just a recent study by the University of New Hampshire, the Graduate School of Business, looking at what's the difference between investor-owned parks and resident-owned communities. And they found not only are the fees lowered resident-owned communities, but the homes sell for more and the homes sell faster. And so if we think in America, home ownership is a way to personal assets, and we've talked about the quality of these homes, and they're just can't even roll them off a lot. Well, you know, some of them are like that, but some of them are not. And we take this as a given that manufactured homes are depreciable assets. And in fact, what the research shows is that if you combine the home, if you find accessible financing with long-term leases and ownership of the land, that those homes do not lose that kind of value, that they can retain value for those low-income homeowners. So it really is a factor. There's environmental factors. There's things in the systems. We can change those things in the system so we can make that system of affordable home ownership and manufactured parks work better for those residents. And that's something that we want to do. It's really, I think, represents huge things. It's a systemic problem, and we want to, you know, act on it as a systemic problem. And land ownership is absolutely vital, crucial to any kind of asset appreciation that's ever going to happen in those homes and the stability for those homes. Because just think about it, you have 30 days, you own your home, you're never going to get conventional financing, you're never going to get any of the other things that typical people who own those homes get if you have a 30-day lease on the land under your home. So what this bill does is it gives people long-term ownership of land under their home. So we think that this is a bill. It's fair, reasonable. It's completely feasible. We have done two of these transactions. We can do more of these transactions. Other nonprofits can. There are people out there that can help residents do these. It's to me a really clear and easy way to deliver an economic development, an economic benefit to very low-income homeowners. And we do not think it places an undue burden on the other party. They get the same price. It's a transaction. It's a market-based transaction, but it's one that results in significant benefits for these low-income homeowners that they wouldn't have in the alternate transaction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And now we have Amy Redgrove. Is that right?
Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself, please.
Good.
Thank you, Madam.
Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amy Frederick-Gill, and I'm the Managing Director of the Minnesota Association of Cooperatives. So we are the statewide trade association that works with all types of cooperative businesses, ranging from the agriculture industry, farm supply and grain and dairy co-ops, to the rural electric co-ops, credit unions, healthcare, transportation, and most importantly here today, housing co-ops. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today in support of the right of first refusal legislation. MAC strongly supports HF 1301 because of the opportunity it creates for residents to convert their park to a co-op and to become a member owner of the home park. Minnesota is the number one co-op state, if you didn't know that. Member owners of a co-op share equally in the control of a cooperative. Unlike investor-owned corporate directors, co-op directors have a direct stake and interest in the well-being of the cooperative because they are also patrons of the co-op. Co-op directors don't receive stock options, loans, or other financial incentives that can often cloud their better judgment. All net savings left after bills are paid and money is set aside for operations and improvements are returned to co-op members. This would represent a significant change from the current situation at most manufactured home parks in Minnesota. We work closely with housing co-ops, primarily with senior housing co-ops at this point in time, and observe the resident member owners of the senior housing co-ops growing and flourishing with their ownership and leadership capacities at senior housing co-ops. This bill would help extend those opportunities to manufactured home park residents. The number of senior housing co-ops in Minnesota actually has grown to 70, and Minnesota is now the number one state in the nation for senior housing co-ops. But Minnesota, however, is not anywhere near the number one state for manufactured home park co-ops. And we'd like to ask for your support of this bill to help allow residents of manufactured home parks to have the opportunity to truly take control of their community. Through housing co-op ownership, more and more housing co-op members are benefiting from owning a piece of real estate and learning how to live cooperatively. Co-ops are self-governed by boards of directors and operate under a one-member, one-vote premise. Manufactured home parks are well-suited to take advantage of this cooperative business structure with this what this legislation would help facilitate. MAC has been involved with this issue for a number of years and thinks that it is an important issue. And in closing, I'd like to thank you for your support of this legislation, and thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, one resident who would like to just say a very brief statement.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and if you'd like to just introduce yourself, please.
I'm Sabina. Hello, Representative Clark and members of the Housing Policy and Finance Committee. I am a homeowner in the city of Lexington in the Paul Revere Cooperative, which has room for 156 homes. I am one of the fortunate ones. I live in one of Minnesota's two resident-owned park communities. First one was Cannon Falls, where the second one. The residents purchased the park on October 3rd, 2005 from Phil Johnson over here, an owner, who was very cooperative with us. He could have sold the park to some developers, but he made a promise and he was good on his promise, and he helped us all the way along on becoming a co-op. I am the chairman of the Fall River Activities Committee. In the past, I had to live with the same uncertainty that 50,000 families in Minnesota have to face every day. Is this the day I receive the park closure notice letting me know that in 9 months' time I'll be forced to abandon my home and move away from my job, friends, and family? Or will this be another day that I and my neighbors will be forced to deal with park improvements not being made, park rules being applied unfairly, and rent being raised on a whim? Everything has changed now. I no longer experience the daily fear of losing my home. As a result, I and my neighbors are able to make improvements to our homes, knowing that it won't be more money that we stand to lose. We have also started to welcome people from Whispering Oaks, a park in Oakdale that is closing for redevelopment. That is, in fact, a reality in August. And we've got three people coming in, and they are very relieved to move into a community where they can feel secure and mainly not homeless. And we are further getting some more people from Whispering Oaks. My household budget also feels a little more manageable, knowing that rent will only go up when the cost of managing the park does. As neighbors, we have also come together to make improvements in our community. We completely redeveloped our community center, added more green space, hold regular activities to bring the neighborhood together, and plan to start a neighborhood watch. For instance, right now, with the cold weather and the snow, we have a maintenance committee to help people's pipes and stuff like that. This was a long, hard, nerve-wracking process for the residents. Without the kinds of policies that are being proposed today, it took us nearly 3 years to take control of our park. I, and I know the other residents of Paul Revere, feel liberated by this change, and we hope that the Minnesota legislature will make it easier for other residents to preserve their communities.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. We have a number of people who would like to testify in the opposition, and we have a couple of questions. What I'd like to do, members, with your permission, is go ahead and hear the opposition, and then we have questions afterwards. And I know we're getting close to the end of time here.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Mr. Bruner, I believe, is
Mr. Bruner
first. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Mark Bruner. I'm with the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. We represent the industry, manufactured home community owners. There are about 1,200 manufactured home parks in the state, about 50,000 home sites, and of that number, about 85% are represented by our association. And we have serious concerns and reservations about this bill. But what I would like to do is just walk the committee through, if I could, how current law works. Yes, there is a right of first refusal that exists in Minnesota statute right now, and it relates to a property that's closing. Any of the witnesses that testified, they're concerned about a closure. They're protected right now with the right of first refusal. If it's going to be redeveloped, they have the opportunity to match the offer and the terms and conditions and to acquire that property. Additionally, anytime a manufactured home park owner offers for sale in a public way, whether it's listing with a real estate broker, putting an ad in a newspaper, that they're interested in selling their property, the residents have to be notified of that. And the reason the legislature did that is because we had this discussion several years ago before this committee. And the idea was that by giving the residents notice that the owner's interested in selling, they have the opportunity to get organized, make an offer to purchase the property. And, you know, essentially that's what happened when the previous witness mentioned the Paul Revere community that was sold to a cooperative. While the owner hadn't publicly given notice that he was interested in selling, the residents approached the owner, said they were interested in purchasing the community. He said he was interested in selling. It happened. There was no right of first refusal necessary. You had an interested buyer, a willing seller, and it happened. What this proposal essentially does is just put in place some barriers for a manufactured home park owner to sell their property, fundamental property rights, and there's no assurance even in the end if there were a right of first refusal that the property would sell. We will have owners that will lose prospective buyers who come to make an offer. If a co-op or resident organization isn't able to purchase the property, what happens then if the previous person making the offer decides that they're going to move on to other opportunities or other investments? The community owner's left with nothing whatsoever. So we have serious concerns. There was also a notice made to a reference to that, you know, cooperatives are something of benefit to the residents of manufacturing. We don't disagree with that. We think that cooperative ownership certainly has its merits. It's working in Paul Revere, but the idea that a manufactured home park should somehow have a right of first refusal place on it would be essentially the only property in the state of Minnesota where that exists. We heard from other cooperative organizations here a few minutes ago that indicated you have grocery stores, you have others. To our knowledge, anytime a grocery store, any type of other business goes on the market, there is no other right of first refusal that places the co-op or those who frequent the business ahead of any other purchasers. This would be very unique, very rare in terms of real estate. And for those reasons, we oppose it. You know, we are the people who were given credit for developing, if you will, the state's largest source of affordable housing in Minnesota. And that's true. We're non-subsidized. There are 1,200 manufactured home parks in the state. And it was the private ownership, the ability to attract investors to develop a manufactured home park that made that possible. And we would not want to discourage future development by putting in place a right of first refusal that essentially takes away one's ability to sell their property to someone else who is going to keep the property open as a manufactured home park. And please keep that in mind when looking at the bill. We're not talking about closures. We're talking about someone selling a property to someone else who's going to continue the operation as a manufactured home park. If that changes, current law allows for a right of first refusal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Next witness. If you'll introduce yourself, please. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Schrader. I am a family member of a family-owned business that owns 11 manufactured housing communities in Minnesota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. None of those other states currently have any right of first refusal at any time, whether it's closing or otherwise. My primary concern with this bill is that it absolutely destroys the free market for manufactured housing communities. I'm also a licensed real estate broker and participate in a lot of commercial transactions, and it is absolutely unheard of for a party to receive a right of first refusal unless it's compensated for as part of another transaction. We have accounted for the primary concern that residents have, which is the park closure scenario. They will have the right of first refusal, and that's we're talking about preserving this product type that does afford for that right of preservation. But I will tell you that if this bill passes, there will be no transactions to third-party buyers. I don't know of any national buyers or local buyers who will participate in a transaction where they will not be able to negotiate at arm's length with the seller. This bill requires that the price and terms of their offer be published. It also requires that even if they do purchase the property, that there is a durable right of first refusal, which applies to their term of ownership, even if they do not intend to close the property. So this type of right of first refusal has been challenged in many other jurisdictions. The state of California has ruled it unconstitutional as a taking for private purpose. So we really very much question the constitutionality of this, and there will be litigation, I just know it, if this passes. I think, you know, we talk about fair market value. Fair market value is determined by a willing seller selling property to a willing buyer. The transfer of the interest here from month-to-month tenants of personal property is unheard of. It is too much of a transfer of the bundle of rights that a fee simple absolute real estate landowner should have on their property. Essentially, it says the tenants will own this property. And I just find it kind of disingenuous to laud all of these people as, you know, advocates of affordable housing. These are the people who have done it with their own money. These are the people who have developed these properties. Now they're going to get hammered because they can't sell their property. And nobody's going to compete against this from a buying standpoint if they know that at the end of the day, somebody's going to be able to trump their price based on that. If you went to sell your home and your neighbor was given a right of first refusal on your home, there would be nobody that would come to purchase that home. Think about it. I think the expansion of this right will destroy market manufactured housing in Minnesota. We're fighting hard right now to keep occupancies in our communities. We're trying to work with local municipalities and with residents to create good, clean housing stock. But this will really challenge that undertaking. And I guess I would just close by saying the only buyer under this new statute would either be my brother or my sister or North Country Co-op. And that is not a fair market transaction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schrader. Is there another witness? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. My name is Phil Johnson. Was referred to a little earlier. I was the previous owner of Paul Revere Community. I sold it to the residents through North Country Co-op. And I'm here to tell you that there was no right of first refusal in existence at that time, and it's not necessary. The residents certainly have the right at any time to organize, to put together their financing, just like any other purchaser would do or a prospective buyer would do, and to approach any owner of any property and let them know that they have an interest in purchasing the property. And that's what happened in the case of Paul Revere. some of the residents, although I think it was a small number to start out with, had an interest in being owners. They contacted North Country Co-op, which in turn contacted me. They caught me at the right time. I had an interest in selling. And I told them that. I established a price, which I thought was a fair price. I understand that their appraisal later on was higher. So that's okay. I established the price, and we struck the deal. It didn't. That can happen now. That can happen tomorrow. I have other properties, and if the owners would like to organize and would like to let me know that they are willing to buy and they're able to buy, I may be willing to sell. So I conclude by telling you that this right of first refusal is unnecessary, and I agree with the previous testimony of Mr. Schrader that it will have an extremely negative impact on our industry and the manufactured home community if for the past. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, so we've heard from both the witnesses in support and in opposition, and I've got a couple of people who want to speak, Representative Anderson and Representative Schomburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a no from your testifiers. When people move into a manufactured house, they sign a contract, I take it, with the park owner or the person who owns the facility there. Do you know how long the contract is for, how long those leases are, or those contracts that the homeowner signs with the park owner?
Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson, Representative Anderson, excuse me just for clarification, your question is, should this happen?
I'm just asking, is there a contract that's signed by the park or the resident as he comes into the park who wants to live in a manufactured home? Does he sign a contract with the park owner?
Madam Chair?
No.
Welcome to the committee. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Madam Chair, Ron Elwood, Legal Services Advocacy Project. Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, it's my understanding that if a person moves into a park, signs a lease.
Madam Chair, Mr. Elwood, how long is the lease for, do you know?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I believe the lease stays in effect until either the park closes, the resident moves, the lease stays in effect. There can be changes to that lease based on current statute, presuming that the changes are reasonable. And rents can be increased twice a year under current law.
Madam Chair, I know that as a legislator, we come down here and we rent an apartment for a certain amount of time, or we have in the past, and lots of us still do. We rent it for a certain amount of time, and it's either for a year, but we have to renew that every year. Is that the case with a person who lives in a manufactured home with the lease? Do they have to renew that on a, say, a 5-year basis or a 10-year basis?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, no, but the significant difference is that you're renting an apartment and these folks own a home. So it's kind of it's a hybrid sort of a situation. It is not really analogous to, it's not completely analogous to an apartment rental as you do when you come down here to St. Paul.
Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Shepard?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just want to discuss the bill briefly, and I think it's a very good bill, and I hope everyone paid attention to the pretty nice tax incentive in the bill for the park owner when they sell the bill. And just a comment, I think because of the unique relationship because of the resident and the park owner, the fact that the resident owns the house and it's located on land owned by the park owner, that's such a unique relationship that I think the right of first refusal is warranted in this case. And let's remember that the residents have to match the offer. And if they can't match the offer, in 90 days they lose any chance of buying the property. And, you know, if this property is worth so much as we keep hearing, you know, who knows? Maybe in many cases the residents may not be able to match the offer. And so I don't see why this is going to dry up all sales to anybody other than residents. It just seems to me it depends on the market.
Representative Wallace, did you have a comment?
No, no comments.
Then Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, my question is kind of a follow-up to Representative Chumper's. There is a lot of good things in this bill, and specifically, I wanted to talk. Evidently, I wanted to be sure I was reading on page 2, line 12. So it is, Representative Moles, your intent that the sellers would now become exempt from the capital gains tax, which could be of significant value. And is that the intent of this legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, correct.
Okay, and then I have a couple of follow-ups. I'm wondering, first of all, Madam Chair, I think we need to have a fiscal note because there would certainly be a potential tax implications for the state of Minnesota. And I, Representative Moore, we do not have a fiscal note, do we?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, we don't have one yet. We will request one, and this will be going to taxes.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I can do a follow-up, aren't we supposed to have that already here to be doing these bills? What is the policy? I'm trying to remember. I thought we used to get the fiscal notes in the committee when we were discussing the bills.
Representative McNamara, we'll certainly try. Now, the fiscal impact here will be something the tax committee will be dealing with. It doesn't come out of this committee's budget. He'll need to have it by the time he gets to tax committee, believe me.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then my other question was, just real quickly, how many times has the current right of first refusal been used by parks? I mean, we have one today, and I'm just wondering, we heard one instance where they actually didn't use the right of first refusal. It took quite a while to negotiate. Has this current right of first refusal ever been used? And then I would imagine to get your fiscal note, somebody's going to make an assumption about how many times this one will be used. And is it the intent that it will be used any more than the current one?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, the current law has not been used for a couple of reasons. There was a couple examples where the ownership has been transferred willingly to cooperatives. Mr. Johnson, I appreciate we all do his willingness to work with the landowners. But the reality is it's never been required to be used forcibly because 45 days is too short a period of time to allow for financing to be in order. And there's really no significant incentive currently for park owners to sell to tenants, and that's thus the tax incentive portion of the bill.
Representative Moll, you have the bill of support. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Schrader's testimony, I think one of the things that he had brought up was that it takes away from the ability to market the park if, in fact, this right of first refusal goes forward. But I think it's important to note on the bill, if the purchaser intends to close the manufactured home park or convert it to another use, so this would only be triggered if the new buyer intended to do that, to close it down.
No, sir.
No, it's not.
That's not true?
No, sir. It's all transactions.
All transactions.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
And I was going to follow up on Representative Stevenson. Line 4.16 does say, shall make a final unconditional acceptance of any offer. So any offer that comes aboard. If Mr. Schrader decided he would sell his park to another operator, Mr. Phil Johnson, and Mr. Johnson was going to continue to operate the park, this triggers that full disclosure back to residents. What you're creating there is an expectation of the residents, puts them into a hype. I mean, is that really very destructive because if the park's going to continue to operate, why put the residents through that emotional upheaval? Notification is one thing, but to make that full disclosure, if the park intention was to close it, as the old language said, that's a different story. But again, what I'm hearing Mr. Schrader says, he can, in good faith, turn around and sell it to another operator, Mr. Bill Johnson, and continue the park going. Am I missing something?
Madam Chair, Mr. Peterson, in spite of the threats to the contrary, and I think the reality is these owners, are the homeowners here, are sitting on pretty shaky ground now.
They do not own the property in which their home is. And many of us here are homeowners. Imagine not owning the property in which your homeowner is now. So there's a certain amount of unsureness, instability in their lives currently. If they have an opportunity to actually purchase that property that their home sits on, ultimately it will provide more stability for the homeowners and the families, one, and two, provide them with an opportunity to get a lower interest loan also on their property, allowing, again, for more financial security for the family.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schrader had a reaction.
Madam Chair, the only thing I would also add is this bill does not carry the same provisions for the co-ops that it does for the owners. For instance, if a co-op owned the community and the residents determined that Home Depot came along, or Walmart, that was what you used before, they could sell to them without triggering this or the park closure scenario or any of that. We don't have the same right to do that. And secondly, their prohibition lasts for 15 years, and then they can do whatever they want in the bill.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, 15 years we put in this bill purposely to allow for try to avoid any transfer of ownership to someone else. So, I mean, we could put in a longer number if as a negotiation, 30 years or 50 years for that matter. But we put 15 years. We thought that was a reasonable safeguard to transfer to Home Depot.
I just remind members, this bill's going to two other committees. One is local government next, and then taxes. And so, there's plenty of time if there are some additional issues. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moe, I would highly encourage you to take a look at that ownership transfer. Mm-hmm. I mean, in these 1,200 or 1,800 parks, what was the number again?
1,200.
Most of those you would want to keep in the hands of professional operators. And you need to encourage that. This does not do that. You need to allow a good operator A to buy another park, operator B come in and continue that park perpetually under good management. Because if the tenants wanted to form a co-op at any given time, they could come up with it. I'm sure they could walk into Mr. Schrader on any Saturday afternoon and say, hey, we'd like to buy your park, and he'd probably start negotiating with them. If you don't do that, I would suggest you're going to have an exit of all these 1,200 park owners are going to start looking for an exit strategy right away, and it's going to trigger something you may not want to have happening.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Mr. Peterson, Representative Peterson, excuse me.
You call me Neil.
Neil. You know, I know that you're a supporter of tenants in manufactured home parks. So I would be more than happy to sit down with you and talk through your thoughts and ideas on this between now and the next committee. I think
talk to a couple of these operators. I think they can help you through that.
Right. I mean, I'm not sure I agree with you, and so maybe there might be something I'm not seeing here. But again, the bottom line, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is we've got working class family homes at risk here. We've got tenants who are just many times just hanging on. If we can provide them with an additional level of security, that's the intention of this bill, and I appreciate the committee's support.
Okay. The bill is before us, House File 1501. Representative Moe moves that it be passed and re-referred to local government. All those in favor signify.
To first? Excuse me?
The taxes first, are we saying?
Madam.
Excuse me. Representative Moe, are you changing your motion?
We don't need to go to any.
But taxes.
The people I'm working on with this legislation informed me that local government doesn't yet want to see this. We will amend that motion to send it to taxes.
Right. Motion would be to refer 1501 to taxes. Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
motion prevails, and 1501 is referred to taxes. Members, please again check in with our radio, our weather person here. Right, well, she'll be listening to the radio. We want to make sure whether or not we have our committee meeting on Thursday, so we're not going to endanger anybody's lives, believe me. The meeting is adjourned.